Thank you, Pat. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is work that I've done for about the last 16 years. I've been doing a lot of work around HIV prevention trials, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. A lot of effort has been put into sort of engaging the community actively in the design and conduct of those trials for reasons I'll talk about. As you might know, I have no personal financial relationships, commercial interests that are relevant to this presentation because professors make so much money, they don't need to have a commercial relationship with anyone else. We don't have that much time, and clearly I'm not going to be able to give you a real, I'm just going to give you a taste of what community consultation might entail and some of the issues and challenges that come up. I'm not even going to really talk about the ethics of it, because even though I am the chair of the ethics group, I think it's pretty obvious to us all that in order for us to engage in community-based participatory research, it's important to engage the community in all steps of the research process. And so when you look at the nature of some of these projects, it requires a number of different things to create a supportive research environment. So we need government policies and regulations that facilitate research. We never really worried too much about that until about the past 3 or 4 years, and we're really seeing a massive decline right now in government support and funding for community-based research projects, and a real change in the way that the political system views the research endeavor, which is unfortunate. A lot of the work I do in sub-Saharan Africa and in Asia, some of the real challenges are ensuring that we have adequate research facilities and other resources, particularly because of global health inequities and global research inequities, ensuring that there are sufficient numbers of researchers from relevant disciplines. And unfortunately, for community consultation purposes, we have a real dearth of folks like myself who are not only trained in sort of biomedical research, but also have a lot of experience and training on the social science side. And one of the things that we found is a lot of programs now, the first thing that gets cut when your budget gets slashed by the NIH by 30% is all of the formative social science research. You also need a pool of properly trained staff at local research sites. This is a real opportunity, of course, to build capacity within the communities, but it can also pose a challenge because you begin to draw folks away from many of the public health clinics and other sort of services that serve the larger community and entice them to become members of a much more focused research project. So in some ways, you have to be very cognizant of the fact that community-based participatory research can actually have a really adverse impact on the community as a whole by essentially creating a brain drain. And then finally, you need to have public awareness and support of the research project. I want to focus primarily on that public awareness and support issue, and it really has three key components. It's got a scientific literacy component, and that is helping the community understand how clinical trials work and how to be active partners in the research process. And that can be particularly challenging if you're working in a low to middle income country where you have people who have little to no formalized education. These are not dumb people, but they really don't have a lot of the formalized education in the scientific process. And so really start from ground zero in order to build up the understanding of the community about what a clinical trial is. And it becomes very important because you have to combat things like therapeutic misconception, which is the notion that by joining the trial, they're definitely going to receive care that makes them better. You have to battle any number of sort of misconceptions about what the scientific process is about. And particularly if you're coming from a developed country and you're funding a study that is a $10 million study, there's perceptions that also occur about what research is about in those communities. There's also a community literacy component that a lot of people don't think about. Community consultation is not just a one-way process, but it's really a two-way street. You need to have an effort to help researchers themselves understand what the communities are, the communities they're working in, how they work, how they think, and how to best engage with them. And then finally, you have to create an environment of transparency and trust. And so that's making sure that this dialogue continues at all stages of the research process, from the initial formative research all the way up through the close of the trial, the dissemination of the results, and even years later when you're talking about access to products that maybe come out as a result of research endeavors. And I think we all are very familiar with what happens if you don't do this. This is really a change we've seen in the past 30 years or so. A lot of it catalyzed by advocacy and activism among communities that are directly affected by diseases of consequence. So we have the Storm the NIH situation, which was ACT UP, actually beginning to really create a movement whereby affected communities began to demand to be part of the research process. And so this is where you begin to finally start seeing a two-way dialogue. You have the situation with the closure of the Cambodia and Cameroon pre-exposure prophylaxis trials. And so that's actually a photo I took, oddly enough, and I don't know how it's gotten disseminated over the internet. But that was at the International AIDS Conference back in 2004. And then many of you probably don't know who the woman in the lower corner is. That's Carletta Tolusi. She's a member of the Havu. Thank you. Sorry, I've got really bad cold, and so I actually can't speak well. The Havasupai tribe in Arizona, and many of you are probably familiar with what happened with that case. But you know, for those of you who aren't, the Havasupai tribe is only 650 members total. They live in a very geographically isolated part of Arizona in the Grand Canyon. And as a result, they actually are genetically isolated. And so there's a lot of interest in studying them, particularly in relation to diseases that are prevalent in that community. And type 2 diabetes is very prevalent in the Havasupai tribe. 55% of the women and 33% of the men in that tribe have type 2 diabetes. And so what happened was back in 1989, faculty members from Arizona State University actually approached the tribe to get permission to do a study looking at genetic factors associated with type 2 diabetes in that community. Unfortunately, what happened is because there wasn't a very good community consultation process, community members were distraught when they discovered, for example, that the researchers at Arizona State University were using the samples for other research projects, including a study looking at schizophrenia and including a study that looked at migration of indigenous peoples in North America. And when a paper came out that actually showed that the Havasupai tribe, sort of mapped their migration across the Bering Land Bridge and down through North America, it really challenged some of their basic core origin beliefs. And so they sued. And the lawsuit was settled out of court for $700,000 recently. But it's very easy to sort of automatically say, well, of course the Havasupai tribe, had a case. But the fact of the matter is, it really was a failure not of the researchers to sort of be honest about the research that was occurring, but actually to engage in a dialogue and discussion about the cultural values of that community. For example, they would have done the genetic migration studies anyway in order to demonstrate the genetic isolation of this population. That was standard practice even for the gene association studies with the type 2 diabetes, but that was never explained to the community, so you could understand how the community got very upset. So what are the key lessons that we've learned? Well, you either include the community and hear from them directly, or you exclude the community from the research process and you hear from them indirectly, either through marches in the streets or lawsuits in the courts. And so really, what we're seeing is that community consultation is becoming an increasingly common way for involving communities in community-based participatory research. And there are different models of consultation, which I really don't have the time to go into, but these can involve anything from passive transfer of information to what is becoming more and more of the model, which is a two-way dialogue, or what we like to see, which is active partnership in research. And I just want to give you an example of active partnership in research that I've been engaged in, and that's the use of community advisory groups and community advisory boards. Now, a community advisory group, or a CAG, is a group of volunteers from the local community who assist and advise researchers at a given site. And so they insist to ensure that the needs of the local community are considered in all matters regarding the research project, from the provision of research-related care to program management to the establishment of a scientific agenda. Community advisory boards, or CABs, tend to be larger organizations. And they advise researchers at a national or a network level. So in large HIV prevention trials, which take place at multiple sites in multiple countries, you tend to have a CAG at each site, and then you may have members, representatives from those CAGs serve on a larger CAB that provides overall input and advice to researchers at a network level and at a transnational level. And there's a lot of value added by inclusion of CAGs and CABs. For researchers, it helps build trust, it helps recruit and retain a diverse study population, and it helps facilitate acceptance and increase awareness of the study. And for the community, this involvement in science ensures really good clinical and scientific practice. It helps address ethical issues, it helps address social issues, and it ensures that the procedures, the information, all aspects of the research trial are being done in an appropriate and culturally sensitive manner. Ideally what you want to have is you want to have the CAB-CAG system working at all stages of the research design and conduct. But that can be a real challenge because, it's very hard to sort of engage the community in the earliest formative stages of the research process. And I know that the people who are going to follow me on this panel will talk a little bit about sort of engaging the community at all levels, including in the review process. So what do? Well, they provide input to the scientific agenda and participate in study development. They develop and review culturally appropriate materials. They help with community outreach, and they foster a supportive environment. More importantly, they help resolve conflicts that arise. So CABs and CAGs often play very much a facilitation or mediation role when there's disagreements between the researchers and members of the community. And I've seen that at play myself when there have been concerns about it was a study involving cultural acceptance of a vaginal ring approach to developing a microbicide among commercial sex workers in Mombasa, and a number of religious figures within Mombasa actually raised concerns about the study. And what the CAB and CAG did was step in and say, listen, we represent the community of women who are participating in this study, and we support it. And the religious figures backed up. So what are some of the challenges? Defining community, inclusion of hard-to-reach populations, some of the logistical and language and cultural barriers. And the one I really want to focus on is the challenge of just defining what community is. You can identify with a large number of communities, and this can be a self-identity. For example, I am a member of the recovering Catholic community. I am a member of the Washington, D.C. community. So I live here in D.C., so that's geographical. I am a strong progressive, so I have a political community I belong to. Particularly when you begin to work in studies that are focusing on particular aspects of disease, you can also have communities that didn't exist until the study occurred. So all of a sudden, someone who's living with HIV/AIDS, when they are targeted to take part in a treatment study, they become part of a new community they didn't even know existed. And so then the question becomes, how do you define that community, and how do you determine who speaks for that community? Who are the legitimate sort of leaders of a community that maybe didn't even exist until you began to design the stud. And then how do you make sure that you're including all relevant stakeholders? One of the problems we saw with the Cambodia and Cameroon trials was the fact that the commercial sex workers believed that they were excluded from the consultation process. Some of the local NGOs and activist groups in Cameroon believe that they were excluded from the process. And so that can actually create a real problem when you have members of a community who are excluded and then begin to question the design and conduct of the study. And finally, the larger and more inclusive you are in making sure that you have inclusion of all of these relevant stakeholders, the more challenging it becomes to make sure that you have consensus about what should be the key aspects of the study design. And so finally, what I want to just leave you with is the idea that community consultation can be a really challenging and time-consuming process, but it really is essential for community-based participatory research projects because it helps build and maintain public trust. It helps researchers learn about the values, cultural and social norms, and language and literacy issues of the community. And it helps recruit, enroll, and retain participants, and also helps in the dissemination of information about the study, particularly once it ends, and also provides information about access to new interventions and new treatments should they arise as a result of a positive study result. And so with that, I'd like to thank you.